You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. I'm David Ramil, a credential reporter and the host of Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Please make sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get the latest episodes. After a tough loss in Game 3, there were questions about how Miami would respond on Wednesday night, particularly about their energy levels in the first half of games that had led to some large double-digit deficits in Games 1 through 3. In Game 4, however, the Heat did just enough to hold a narrow 6-point lead at the half and to hold Celtics all-star Jason Tatum to some 0-for-6 shooting. But Tatum predictably bounced back, shooting 10 of 16 in the second half and exploding for 28 points. And while the Heat had managed to build a 12-point lead, Boston clawed their way back slowly but surely into the game, even taking the lead midway through the fourth quarter. From there, it was a really tightly contested game, with Miami finding a way to keep scoring and defending at a high level, even as some very, very questionable officiating kept things a lot closer than they should have been. But Jimmy Butler hit some big free throws down the stretch as time mercifully ran out to give Miami a 3-1 lead in the Eastern Conference Finals and a 112-109 win. But there's no bigger story on the night than Tyler Herro, however, who played 36 minutes off the bench to score 37 points, a historically great performance for a rookie, not just in franchise history, but league history. Tyler was 14 of 21 from the floor, 5 of 10 from three-point range, and 4 of 4 at the line, including some clutch free throws down the stretch to help Miami hold on to their slim lead. He added 6 rebounds and 3 assists as well. Just a great all-around game, but it was the scoring, the likes of which continues to amaze me and anyone watching this team, that was the most incredible thing about a game that has Miami one win away from reaching the NBA Finals. And that's as big a part of the scoring outage from Herro that I think is going to get lost in everything else, is that it was in such a huge situation, a must-win game for Miami to hold on to a lead in the series, to keep the Celtics from building momentum after their big win in Game 3. This is a very close series with both teams very, very evenly matched, with games coming down to the wire on almost every occasion. No, not on every occasion. And Herro continues to step up. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The hiatus gave him as big a boost as any player in the NBA. For him to take off those few months during the hiatus were such a huge boon for him to continue to work and develop in his game, to continue to polish his shooting, his ball handling ability, his passing ability, which I asked him about after the game, his ability to continue to get other teammates engaged, to make the right play. It was something the broadcast team brought up a number of times, but it really does seem like this isn't just a 20-year-old or just a rookie. It's an NBA superstar in the making, a guy who understands when to make the right play, how to make the right play, when to be aggressive and look for his shot. And he was able to knock down a series of shots like we've never seen before. This is as athletic a player, as polished a scorer as we've ever seen in NBA and Miami Heat franchise history. He is up there with Dwayne Wade. He's up there with LeBron James, a guy who can score in such a number of ways. Maybe it's not in the same way. He's not as powerful a dunker as Dwayne or LeBron, but he's still a great shooter, a guy who can create off the bounce. He's got a really good handle, underrated passing ability, and he is a very polished scorer, and he continues to impress teammates. Everybody after the game was just talking about Tyler. Again, 37 points in a must-win game in the Eastern Conference Finals. That's no small feat. Many players shy away from that kind of spotlight, but he seems to embrace it. And he was just as confident as he was in a midseason game in late February. For him to be able to continue to put on these kinds of shows, as we've been seeing in the Orlando bubble, just continues to impress me and everybody who follows this team. And I just cannot say enough about a rookie who continues to show such polish, such poise in key situations. We've seen it in clutch moments throughout the regular season before the hiatus, but we're watching it now on a whole different level. This is just him in a quiet bubble environment in Orlando, putting on an incredible display of scoring prowess, the likes of we have not seen in franchise history. So I just wanted to mention that because I really think that is the story of the game, is watching Tyler embrace the moment to be as confident as he's ever been, to understand what it takes for him to be able to get going. Now, of course, he deflected all the attention after the game, saying it was his teammates who were trying to get him going, that it could be any teammate on any given night. I don't buy that for an instant. We've seen Jimmy Butler struggle. We've seen Goran Dragic struggle. And although Tyler perhaps isn't going to be as consistently great as he was on Wednesday night, the fact remains that he does seem much more aggressive than anybody else on that roster. He does not seem to shy away, even when he's being challenged, even when he's defended well. He just finds a way to get to the rim, to put up a floater of a larger defender, or to rise up from beyond the arc off the dribble for a big shot. And he seems to be making them at such a high level that we are just left with our jaws dropping to the floor in amazement as he puts on an incredible display. The only negative thing about Wednesday's win was that midway through the fourth quarter, it seemed like Bam Adebayo got his left arm tangled up with Jason Tatum as they were fighting for a rebound. Tatum got called for the foul, but Adebayo seemed to be holding on to his shoulder, wrist, elbow, hand. We weren't quite sure what was going on. After the game, Eric Spoelstra said that there was no injury, that he didn't know anything specific, and that Bam was just getting iced down, that everybody was icing down, that they had all earned it after a big win, and that's absolutely the case. When Bam was asked about it, he said, "I'm good," and didn't talk about it anymore. So I don't know what to make of that. I don't know if there's something there. I don't know if he's just fighting his way through it. I don't know if he's just going to continue to get treatment on Wednesday night and Thursday as they have the day off. They probably will not practice. That would be my guess, is that the teams will both be off to watch film and try to re-engage on Friday night for a pivotal game five. But as far as we know, it looks like Bam's going to be ready to go. So hopefully that will be the case moving forward. If there's any change in that situation, I, of course, will be providing any updates. The officiating was a dark spot on this game as well. There's no way around it. There were some really questionable calls down the stretch. Tony Brothers, Scott Foster, both referees that Miami Heat fans have looked to in the past as having cost the team games. I'm not sure about that or not, but it's pretty evident, at least on Wednesday night, that they made some really bad calls. I'm sure the last two-minute report will show those calls were pretty bad, but it just seemed like they were taking away what little momentum Miami had and what little cushion they had been able to build up, especially late in the game, was just being chipped away by not just Jason Tatum scoring, but also by some questionable officiating. They got a jump ball on a situation where Tatum clearly pushed off of Jimmy Butler and forced the ball out of bounds. But because a foul had been erroneously called on Jimmy Butler, I guess the ruling was overturned and resulted in a dead ball, which then led to a jump ball. Really strange call there. And again, getting it wrong in the sense that maybe that's the spirit of the rule. Maybe that's the actual rule, but it should have been overturned. It should have been Miami ball, clearly, at that point in time when he didn't force the turnover. Where Jimmy did force the turnover, where he forced the ball off of Jason Tatum, and he was pushed off to boot. So I don't know. I there's not much you can say. I've tried to be as calm about the officiating throughout the playoffs as I possibly can be. I've mentioned it before. These things tend to even out over the course of a game or a series, but it was just really, really egregious in those particular moments where Miami was trying to hold on to a win. And I will also add this. This was a darker day, not just for the Heat, but also for franchises in general, for anybody playing tonight, because they were trying to deal with so much outside of the Orlando bubble after a ruling came down in the Breonna Taylor case, where only one of the police officers that had been responsible for her murder were charged. And the charge was a really, well, let's just say it wasn't the right one. There was no justice in the murder of Breonna Taylor. And while there was a $12 million settlement, it won't be enough to restore any kind of sense of justice for those people who have been following this case very closely. And that includes players in the NBA, people who cover the league. And it was an emotional night. Everybody mentioned it. Bam Adebayo continues to end every press conference, every Zoom conference call with the simple phrase that Black Lives Matter. And on a night like tonight, after a ruling like that, where it seems like Black Lives still do not matter, it just continues to overshadow everything that's positive about the Orlando bubble and all the positivity and all the right messaging that has been prepared during the Orlando NBA bubble. I hate to bring it up because, again, this is a positive night. It was a win for Miami, but it just seems like that's continuing to eat away when there's so many other factors about the emotional state of these players having to worry about what's going on in the bubble outside of their current situation is just taking its toll. You can see it on a nightly basis when these players show up. They've been in the bubble for 3 months now. This isn't just like the teams like Memphis or Washington that left the bubble weeks ago. They've been there as teams slowly filter out. There's only four teams left, and while they were able to bring back family members and other people close to them into the bubble situation, it's still taking its toll there. Every day is a difficult one. Andre Iguodala recently spoke about it when he was asked about that emotional toll, and it's pretty clear that it's eating away at everybody. There are some days that are good. You kind of have to find a way to stay positive because this is like no life that they've ever known. This is not the kind of privileged life that you might think NBA basketball players get to enjoy on a daily basis. They're not taking advantage of any of their money, any of their earnings. They can't connect to family the same way that you normally do. And some players like Goran Dragic and Jimmy Butler haven't seen their family in months. Consider that. Goran is a very close family member. You know, he's a family man who has two kids and a wife. And he can't even see them on a regular basis. He has not seen them since he entered the bubble in July. That's got to be taking its toll there. So I just want to keep bringing it up because it's important to consider that even as Miami makes its historic postseason run. But I'll continue getting to some more takeaways from Miami's huge Game 4 win. And you're listening to Locked On Heat. To subscribe to the show on your favorite app to listen to podcasts and always get the latest episode by asking your smart device to play Locked On Heat when you get in your car to get your team every day. Jimmy Butler continues to be a little inconsistent, but at the very least, one of the positives, one of the things that he mentioned in his press conference on Tuesday before Game 4 was that he wanted to be aggressive, that he wanted to set the tone early, that it was important for the starting unit in particular to bring an energy level because the bench had not been able to perform, that they all recognized as a starting unit and as a team that they were asking too much of the bench to continue to go in there and find their rhythm, especially when they were getting into such large double-digit deficits, that they needed to find a little bit more energy early on. And you could tell right away that Jimmy was looking to be a little bit aggressive, and he certainly did, for the most part, start off on a pretty good level, although he did eventually wind up passing up shots the way he has on occasion. Finished with 24 points, so it was a great night from Jimmy. Played some really solid defense and 8 of 9 from the free throw line, including some clutch free throws, as I mentioned before, to go along with 9 rebounds, 3 assists, a steal, and a block. So great overall night for Jimmy. 8 of 20 from the floor, and there were some shots there, particularly in the second and third quarter, that seemed like they were just falling short. I don't know if you all noticed that as well, but every time he was pulling up for a jumper, whether it was contested, whether it was wide open, even particularly in the mid-range, it just seemed like he was leaving something on there. He was trying to put a little bit too much touch, not enough. The shots were hitting the front of the rim and leading to a rebound. Miami's effort all night was particularly good, even Jimmy's. And even while those shots might have looked a little flat, you can't question his effort and energy level. I think that a lot of people were probably questioning that in Game 3. That wasn't the case in Game 4. While it wasn't a great scoring night, he did not have 40 points. He did not have a huge offensive explosion as many had hoped he would. He was good enough, consistent enough, and still energetic enough to provide a difference and made some right plays down the stretch. So a good overall night from him. I think Goran Dragic is probably not going to get nearly enough attention, but he continues to be a bright spot. He struggled in Game 3, no doubt about it. And while he looked pretty shaky early on in Game 4, he wound up finishing with a 22-point night, 3 of 9 from 3-point line, 8 of 21 overall from the field to go along with 5 rebounds and 3 assists and 2 steals. So he was making the right plays and hit a huge corner 3-pointer down the stretch to help create a little bit more of that cushion that Miami needed every point of in order to hold on to a key win here. There were some struggles in that starting unit. Jay Crowder and Duncan Robinson both finished with just 6 points, a combined 1 of 14. One made 3-pointer between the two of them. Crowder was 1 of 7. Duncan was 0 of 4. I'll talk about this a little bit more in the next segment as I answer some of your listener questions, but it's clear that Boston's defense is doing a really good job of harassing those players. Marcus Smart started defending Goran the way he had in Game 3, which was a huge adjustment from Brad Stevens. And while Kemba Walker is quote-unquote hiding on Crowder, it seems to be doing just enough to keep him from getting into a comfortable rhythm. Perhaps it's that regression that we all feared was finally coming. Either way, he's not as effective as he had been prior in the series, and of course in the Milwaukee series where it just seemed like he was absolutely lights out. Duncan continues to try to work extra hard to get those shots. He continues to set and reset. They do that dribble handoff move, especially between him and Bam Adebayo. And if he doesn't get that shot right away, he passes it back to Bam, resets, goes on, uses the screen again, tries to get that dribble handoff and look for his shot. More often than not, it just hasn't paid off for him. And right now, it just doesn't look like he is getting either easy looks or he doesn't feel comfortable. Some of those shots wind up being open looks that we've seen him connect, or even if they were slightly contended by a smaller defender like Walker, then it seems like he should be able to get that shot off pretty easily, and he's not. And so I wonder if there's going to be any change there. I saw some people tweeting about this, and I understand that Duncan Robinson still has gravity as a shooter, that he's sending multiple guys, multiple defenders to come his way to affect his shooting and get him out of his rhythm. But I don't know if that's necessarily going to be as effective as we think it is. There's only so much benefit you can get as a decoy. If you continue to draw multiple defenders, that's fine. But if nobody else is aggressively looking for their shot, and they weren't for most of the game, other than Tyler Hero, it doesn't seem like there's anybody who's willing to create their shot as easily, as frequently. And so I question whether or not you want to continue to get Duncan as much playing time as he has gotten. And I know you don't want to chip away at his confidence, because you're going to need him either deeper in this series, or especially if you go up against the LeBron James or the Denver Nuggets in the finals, you're going to need that kind of shooting, because it's so timely. It's so impactful. It just makes everything on that offense hum so much more smoothly when he's getting his shot to go down. But he continues to struggle from the field. Bam Adebayo, again, a solid overall night from him. Wasn't getting to his shot as much as he was early on, but eventually he started getting a little bit more comfortable, started taking that mid-range shot, started working the glass a little bit, finished with 12 rebounds, still making plays for others as well, 4 assists, 2 steals, 7 of 11 from the floor for 20 overall points. And while, again, he was dealing with what could have been a shoulder injury or a wrist injury, no one's quite sure, he was still in there for defense. He was still making the right play. He was still a big body, harassing them, collapsing their pick and roll situations. So good as a defender. You can't say enough about what Bam Adebayo does. So he's just another phenomenal night from him. I want to also mention, however, that Eric Spoelstra did tweak his rotations a little bit. We've seen a very poor performance in the Eastern Conference Finals from Kelly Olynyk, and we just didn't see Olynyk at all in Game 4. He was completely on the bench, no minutes at all for him. Derrick Jones Jr. did not get any playing time either. And Eric Spoelstra surprisingly went to Solomon Hill in the second quarter, kind of used him as a defender in the zone. My reasoning for that, at least as far as I know, and Eric wasn't asked about this in the postgame, is that he wanted to get a different look out there for Solomon. He also wanted to see if Solomon could connect on some of his outside shooting. He did an attempt a three-point shot. And so he was a plus two while he was in there. It was a positive. It wasn't much of an impact, perhaps, and wasn't a huge performance from him. And again, only 4 minutes of play. But it seemed like it was a minor tweak there. And I think you have to respect the fact that Solomon Hill can knock down that shot. It's not like Derrick Jones Jr. When Derrick's in there, he's going to get that shot only if everybody else sags off of him and they leave him completely open from the corners or the perimeter at some point. With Solomon, he at least draws a defender. He can make things happen that way. He can put down the ball a little bit more smoothly, too, than Derrick Jones Jr. Not by much, but a little bit better, more effectively. And it was just a weird lineup tweak, but it seemed to work. I wonder what the situation will be like in Game 5, something that I'll answer in the next segment as well. But Andre Iguodala came back despite some back issues. He was able to play a productive 27 minutes, 1 of 4 from the field, so not a great shooting night, but he also finished with 2 assists, seemed to make the right play, and 3 steals defensively, stepping up, getting his hands in there, interrupting passes, blocking passing lanes, moving his body well. A couple questionable fouls that went against him, but overall, just a pretty solid performance from him. So it looks like Spoelstra just feels comfortable tightening his rotation a little bit more. The starting lineup, with the exception of Duncan, played almost 40 minutes on average. Look, Jay only played 31 minutes. Bam played 41. Goran played 39. Jimmy played 39. So their minutes continue to be tied together. Tyler Hero played 36. So he's clearly pushing things a little bit more. Conversely, Brad Stevens on the Boston side did something very similar where he went a little deeper and did not use guys like Grant Williams or Semi Ojeleye a little bit more consistently as he had earlier in the series. He went with Gordon Hayward, who played 30 minutes and finished with 14 points. So he had a much better offensive night than he did in his first outing in Game 3. And still, it wasn't enough. Gordon looked effectively. He was able to knock down the perimeter shot, 2 of 6 from the field, at least from the three-point line, 4 of 4 from the line. So it was a great night for Hayward. And he also wasn't looking to attack the zone as aggressively as he had in Game 3. The zone was mostly effective. It had some moments there where they gave up points because Boston was able to find a seam or exploit the middle, but they weren't doing it as aggressively. They weren't looking to attack it as much as I thought they would. But the question remains, can the Heat hold on to the series lead? I'll answer that along with all of your listener questions in the Lex segment. You're listening to Locked On Heat. One thing that you know you can hold on to is a great taste of Built Bar, because they are absolutely the best tasting protein bar that I've ever had, and you will find that as well. They've got 18 amazing flavors, including 6 new ones, including caramel brownie, cookies and cream, apple almond crisp. They've got all the nutrients that you're looking for, and they are just so good for you. They're low in fat, low in sugars, high in protein. Again, all the nutrients that you're looking for in one great and convenient package. They're great for losing weight or maintaining weight. If you want to indulge in a delicious treat, Built Bar is a way to go. And it's so easy to grab a stack when you're on the go, when you're busy like I am. Sometimes I just never have the time to prepare a full meal, but I want a little snack to tide me over. The Built Bar is the best way to go because I can just get the nutrients I need, and still feel energized and ready to take on the rest of my day. So if you go to BuiltBar.com right now and use the promo code LOCKEDON, you'll get $10 off your next order. Use the promo code LOCKEDON for $10 off your next order at BuiltBar.com. Just a reminder that you can always reach me via email at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. or via Twitter using the hashtag AskYellowHeat. I'll continue recapping the rest of the Eastern Conference Finals throughout the rest of the week. But right now, your listener questions, including this one, comes in from ILJC, who writes in, "Remember the Clippers versus Nuggets? Could this happen to the Heat?" Now, I assume that they're responding to the 3-1 lead. Clearly a concern. And yes, it could happen to the Heat. This has been a very, very tightly contested series. I've mentioned this before, and these teams are very evenly matched. It just seems like it comes down to a big play or a moment of execution that seems to make all the difference. Even in a Game 3 where Boston clearly dominated Miami for most of it, the Heat were still able to cut down the lead to 4 in the fourth quarter. And so that was a huge comeback for them that fell just short. But maybe if they had been able to convert a couple more of their uncontested looks from beyond the perimeter, they might have won the game. The series might be over already. But at the same time, now that they're still up 3-1, Boston could just as easily come back and win the next 3 games. I don't find it very likely. As I've mentioned before, Heat in 6 was my prediction. I think the Celtics could take Game 5. I'd like to see Miami respond with the same kind of energy they had, especially if Bam is healthy and ready to go. I'm hoping that they'll be able to close out the series and not give any kind of life to Boston. I don't want them to be able to make a comeback, because part of my concern is the Orlando bubble. It is such an equalizer for everybody there, and I think that's why we're seeing so many 3-1 comebacks. We've seen it from the Jazz. We've seen it from the Rockets. We've seen lots of these series come back where other teams seem to be clearly outmatched or down in the series, and all of a sudden they find a way to come back. Now, the Nuggets are a very, very good team. It's not the same thing. I think the Celtics are also a very good team, though, and they have the right personnel. They have the good coaching. They've got all the right pieces in place to challenge Miami. But the bubble is such a weird environment. We've never seen anything like it. The shooting has been historically good. There's no fans. There's no energy level from anything other than what you can produce internally. It's a very, very strange environment for players, and changes so much, especially with all the pressures from outside of what's going on in the bubble and the real world outside of the NBA right now. There are so many concerns. And again, it's just about finding your focus, about being able to put aside all the distractions and focus on winning. Miami has been so good at being able to limit the impact that those distractions have, because you can't say that they're completely blocking them out. It's impossible. They're human beings. They're sensitive to what's going on. They're trying to do their best to fight for social justice. But at the same time, there's a lot going on there. And again, there's the whole emotional factor. There's the psychology of being a human being, missing your family members and everything else. It's hard to know whether or not you're going to be able to continue to find that focus on a daily basis. And so it absolutely is a concern. I'm sure Eric Spoelstra is going to give the team off, give them an opportunity, kind of refresh, continue to watch film, see what they did well, come back energized on Friday night, and hopefully put the series away. ILJC also asks about the Bam situation. Can we close the series without him? And there's also a follow-up question from Soyrum, who also asks about Bam and says, what do we do if Bam misses the next game? Well, if Bam misses the next game, you pray, because you really don't have much of a chance. As far as can we close the series without him? No, I don't think we can. That's my feeling. Can you get a big performance from somebody else? Absolutely. You never know in playoff basketball whether or not somebody else is going to step up and have a key situation. Look, Myers Leonard, who hasn't played in the NBA playoffs, was huge for the Portland Trailblazers last season. That was a team that made it all the way to the Western Conference Finals, and they got some huge performances from Myers after Yusuf Nurkic got hurt and was out for most of the year. They hadn't the kind of depth on their center position. They went to Myers, and he put up some huge nights. So you could throw a wrinkle into things. Maybe Kelly finds that form that's been missing for the Eastern Conference Finals. Maybe he's able to knock down shots in the perimeter. Maybe they can do enough from their zone defense where the center position isn't exploited as much as you might think. He is a little bit more mobile than your typical center, so maybe he could get you some minutes. But the reality is that Bam is so good and does so much, not just offensively, but especially defensively, where he can guard 1 through 5. And I know you get tired of hearing about that versatility, but man, it's evident on a nightly basis that he can just shut down your pick and rolls as an opponent. He can guard you straight up and man to man. He can do everything. And that's just such a great benefit to have a player who can do so much. You see him on a nightly basis, sky above everybody else, fight in traffic for a rebound or put up a tough shot in the paint. And that's just the kind of boost that you need on a regular basis when you're falling down or seeing a lead kind of chip away slowly, or when you're trying to fight back or claw your way and mount a comeback, as the Heat have done throughout the series. So those kinds of things are essential, and a guy like Bam brings that on a nightly basis. So it's going to be hard, if next to impossible, to win if you're missing Bam. Hopefully Bam is available on Friday. Again, no updates just yet. We'll hope that he's available, and if there's a change in that, I'll continue to bring any news about it. This next question comes in from Steven, who asks, what do you think about the Heat playing 8, really 7, as far as the rotation is concerned? Can the Heat afford to do so for the rest of the series? Will it affect them if they make the finals? Whew. That is putting the cart before the horse, Steven. Can the Heat afford to do this for the rest of the series? Yes, they can. I think you're going to see tighter rotations from both teams moving forward. We already saw it from Boston. They didn't play Enes Kanter, who had been a great positive as far as his offense is concerned, in games 2 and 3. He didn't play at all in game 4, so you're already starting to see Grant Williams, who was a weird zone buster in some ways in game 3. He didn't get any playing time in game 4. So those tweaks happen and will continue to happen. I think the Heat are going to continue to make those changes as well. It might be Solomon Hill tonight. It might be Derek Jones Jr. the next night. So we'll have to wait and see what Eric Spoelstra feels most comfortable doing. He feels the thing about Spo, and I'll say this, he's got a good pulse on what's necessary. And I think this bubble has really shown how great his flexibility can be in making those decisions. So I like the fact that he is aware of when to make the next choice, when to make the right insertion. And I think that's the benefit of having a team as deep and with the kind of versatility that this team has. And it's why they have been so successful. Not only have they gotten great performances from their star players like Jimmy and Goran throughout the playoffs, but on a night when they might struggle from the field, you get a guy like Tyler stepping up. You get a guy like Duncan. You get a guy like Jay. You get a guy like Kelly Olynyk on occasion, and so on and so on. It's always great to have more depth and more versatility than your opponent. As far as whether or not it'll affect them in the finals, it could. But I think, again, that you trust Eric Spoelstra to make the right decision and say, well, you know what? Let's say Dwight Howard is somehow able to challenge, Bam Adebayo. I don't see it happening, but it could. let's say Bam gets into foul trouble guarding Nikola Jokic. Well, maybe you go in a little different, and then you have Kelly Olynyk stretch Miles Plumlee out a little bit further, Mason Plumlee, excuse me, a little further out on the perimeter, and he's able to knock down those shots. It could happen. It's hard to envision it right now because, again, you're just dealing with Boston, and I don't think you ever want to look too far ahead. Right now, they've got a challenge of closing out the series. That's the paramount thing for them, but I think they can afford to make good personnel decisions moving forward. I trust that Eric Spoelstra will make the right decision. What was the difference in the zone between Game 3 and 4? Steven asks. The Celtics were not as effective. I'll have to go back and look exactly what it was. As I was watching the game, I was a little caught up in the emotion of the whole thing, and I apologize for that. But I also did notice they were not as aggressive at taking advantage of finding that open seam in the middle of the defense. They had a number of opportunities there where they were able to get past the initial wave of defenders on the perimeter, or maybe they passed up a shot at the rim because they were met by multiple defenders, and then somebody was able to get into the middle of the zone defense, and they had a mid-range shot available, and they weren't taking, whether it was Hayward or Smart or Jaylen Brown. I think there were a number of players who just weren't aggressively looking to take that mid-range shot and bust the zone. And I think that was a big difference too. So I'll have to go back and rewatch it, but that was one of the things I noticed early on. The Heat Check submits this question. Looking to game five, how do we get Jay and Duncan going? Tough shooting night for the both of them. I don't know. I don't think there's anything more that you could do. For Jay, he was taking some uncomfortable shots. He did not look fluid, and it might just be the regression factor that we've all dreaded. For Duncan, it seemed like a lot of those shots were the same kinds of looks that he's been getting earlier on in the playoffs, and again, those shots just weren't falling. Maybe they were making minor changes. I think Jaylen Brown is doing a hell of a job defending not just Duncan, but Jimmy and everybody else too. He is a very, very underrated defender. Jason Tatum is great. Marcus Smart is great. They're very, very good. Daniel Tice is solid, even though he does get into foul trouble. Overall, they have one of the best defenses in the bubble for a reason, and they've made things very, very difficult for an explosive offense like Miami, so you do have to take that into consideration. Shaysh, S-H-A-Y-S-H, asks, if we beat the Celtics 4-1, does the national narrative continue to be they haven't played anyone, and what percent chance do you give the Heat to beat the Nuggets or Lakers, respectively? I think there's a little bit of that. I think you could say that maybe people will start to look at the Milwaukee series and kind of reflect more on Giannis Antetokounmpo's injury as being a factor. I think they'll also question whether or not the young core of the Boston Celtics were not ready, even as they overlook the fact that Miami has young players like Tyler Hero stepping up, or Bam Adebayo stepping up, or Duncan Robinson, who is, again, a second-year player, having a big contribution. So it's going to be weird to see whether or not they're able to focus on how good Miami is. But we've seen this throughout the rest of the playoffs, not just with Miami, but with other teams. As the Clippers were collapsing, the focus was on the Clippers collapsing and not the fact that the Denver Nuggets are actually a good team. And their one Anthony Davis shot at the clutch situation away from being 2-1 over the Los Angeles Lakers in that Western Conference final. So I think you see a lot of that where you don't respect a team that has made an unexpected leap in the playoffs. So it's unfortunate, but I think that's just a reality, is that nobody thought the Nuggets or Heat would advance this far. I don't know if anybody thought the Celtics would advance. I think most people thought, and I did too, that Milwaukee would go on a deep run, that Toronto would find a way to win, considering they had won the finals last year. So I don't know that it's necessarily disrespectful to Miami, but it seems like it's pretty commonplace anyway. As far as what percent chance do I give the Heat to beat the Nuggets or Lakers? That's a tough one. I'm not ready to get into it just yet. Call it superstition, but I don't want to focus on anything other than the Boston Celtics moving forward completely. Jade asked this last question. Can we expect the same rotation, or will Spo change it up with maybe Derrick Jones Jr.? Yes? I'm sorry, Jade. I don't have any answers for you. If you had told me after a loss in Game 3 that the answer from Eric Spoelstra would be Solomon Hill playing 4 minutes of action, I would not have been able to guess that. I don't think anybody had that on their Miami Heat Eastern Conference Finals bingo card. So sorry, I don't have any specific answers. I don't know what's going to happen next. It could be Kelly Olynyk. It could be Myers Leonard. It could be anybody on the roster. It's just you never really know with Eric Spoelstra, because he does like to tinker so much. He likes to find some new combination that might work some magic there. I don't think there's anything regarding an injury to Derrick Jones Jr. He just didn't get playing time because his offense has been such a problem for him and for the Heat rotations when he's in the lineup. But that's it for this week, or rather for this recap. I'll continue to recap the Game 5 on Friday, and I'll have an episode later on the week with my former co-host and my host from Locked On NBA, Wes Goldberger, as we recap Games 4 and Tyler Hero's incredible performances. Be on the lookout for that. Be sure to subscribe and follow this podcast to get the latest episode of Locked On Heat as soon as it's out. I'm David Ramil, signing off and thanking you as always for your support.